And we are live and rolling.
Good afternoon. This is a special meeting of the City of Morro Bay City Council. It is Wednesday, June 3rd, 3 p.m. We are holding this meeting via teleconference. And pursuant to Section 3 of the Executive Order N29-20 issued by the Governor Newsom on March 17th, 2020, this meeting will be conducted telephonically through Zoom and broadcast live on cable channel 20 and streamed on the city website. Please be advised that pursuant to the executive order and to ensure the health and safety of the public by limiting human contact that could spread the COVID-19 virus, the Veterans Hall will not be open for the meeting, and the city clerk will be putting up information if you'd like to call in for public comment. So with that, Madam Clerk, could we establish a quorum, please?
Yes, Mayor. Councilmember Addis.
Here.
Councilmember Heller.
Sorry, here.
Councilmember Davis.
Present.
Councilmember McPherson.
Here.
And Mayor Heading.
Here. We do have a quorum, so I will call the meeting to order and open up public comment. This is public comment for items on the agenda only. I will remind you that this is a study session to consider the proposed operating and capital budgets for fiscal 2020-21 year and provide direction as necessary. And specifically, the requested feedback and direction is on page 9 of the staff report. So council members, I'll refer you to that. Obviously, you may bring further items for discussion forward. Just wanted to remind everybody that we will be having the full budget meeting on the meeting next Tuesday, regular city council meeting, and have a in-depth discussion again at that time. So this is a study session. With that, I'll open up public comment. Zeke, do we have any members of the public waiting?
Yes, sir. We have one in the queue, and here they are. Betty Winholtz.
Welcome, Betty.
Unmute. Okay. Are you there, Betty?
She has to unmute herself.
Betty, you have to unmute yourself. Okay, Betty, are you there?
Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can hear
Betty,
you now.
Yes, Betty, we can hear you now. Welcome.
We got some tangle up going on here. You all received my public comment that was published. Thank you. I'm trying to get to, see, how do I reduce this size? I'm having difficulty bringing up my other piece of paper. I wanted to comment on some of the items that the group, the citizens group, talked about. I would like to mention, let me see if I can find it here. I'm having issues for some reason reducing the screen of you guys and being able to see my own screen. I'll basically try to remember what they were. One of them had to do with selling of properties, and I would just remind council that those are one-time monies, and though it may be a good thing to do, I hope you'll do it under a consideration and not immediately, but make sure you explore each of those properties. I think there were about four different ones. I would like to comment on putting in meters, parking meters. And when we explored this about 10 or 15 years ago, San Luis Obispo was the only city doing it at that time. And it was not cost productive at that time because of the initial capital investment and because of the needing to pay wages to the people or peoples who will be collecting the money and maintaining the meters. And so it kind of became a wash. Another of the items had to do with putting preference in the planning department of businesses over residents, and there were two items about this. And I think this is probably the wrong message you want to send to the community, that whether it's residential or business, they needed to be treated fair when they get into the queue, and whether one should be put over another is questionable from a resident, from a resident's perspective. What was another one of the items that was there? The one about increasing traffic tickets was like, really? I don't think that will go over very well. Certainly they should be ticketing anyways, as they should, but to make it a source of income is probably not the way to go. I believe there was one more comment, and I'm not going to remember it. So let me just say, I hope you'll take seriously my suggestion to do a structural change in how we do our money, and that if you would examine that. I know I didn't have exact figures, but I think the principle is there, and it's worth exploring. Thank you.
Thank you, Betty. Zeke, do we have anybody else in the queue?
Yes, sir.
Phone number.
Thank you.
That's great. And there we go. Caller, you're on the line. Caller, you're on the line. Oh, sorry.
Public comment?
Here we go. And caller, you're on the line. Hello? Anybody there? All right.
Hello?
Hello?
Hi.
Dan, can you hear me? Yeah, I can hear you now, Dan. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor, City Council, and staff, and those listening. I'm looking at page 9, which starts out with RV camping. That may be a source of income, not to outdo our financial woes, obviously, but a step. The second is paid parking. As Ms. Wynholtz said, San Luis found it to be revenue neutral. I have also heard Scott Collins comment on this in City Council meeting. He also said it was income neutral because of the cost of people to issue tickets, people to collect monies, people to install the meters, people, all of it. Sale of properties, as Ms. Wynholtz said, that's a one-time gain. It should be carefully metered against the specific property. And then lastly, the sales tax measure for November 2020 ballot. The people of Morro Bay, as all over the United States, have been hurt badly, badly by the COVID-19. Their incomes have been reduced drastically. The city has already hit them very, very hard with the water and sewer rate increases. Yet the city council continues to increase the cost of the sewer project by $6-something million, a total raise of $4.6 million, and the exact cost up, bringing it up to $130.6 million. And I hear Carollo saying, "Yeah, that should be about the end of it." We haven't even really started. The change orders are going to come in like crazy throughout the rest of this project. Anybody that says otherwise is not being entirely truthful. I like Ms. Wynholtz's comments that she sent in, talking about bringing down the sewer enterprise funds to average about $100 per household, and then raise the city sales tax to where people can pay for it. But if the city's goal is just to raise the sales tax, I would not be surprised if it did not pass. People are hurting badly financially, and they're hurting badly from the sewer rate increases by triple and more. I hope the city is not putting all of its eggs in one basket, because if they're planning on this sales tax on passing and not giving the citizens any relief, I would not be counting on that.
Thank you, Dan. 3 minutes is up, sir.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Zeke, anybody else in the queue, sir?
Nobody else with their hand raised, sir.
Okay, I'll just wait a second here. Public comment is still open. If there's anybody that wants to raise their hand that is listening or on Zoom, feel free to do so. Seeing none, I'll go ahead and close public comment and bring it back to council. This is item one on the special meeting agenda, consideration of the City of Morro Bay's proposed operating and capital budget for fiscal year 2020 and 2021. Recommendation is that the council consider the proposed operating and capital budget and provide direction as necessary. Specifically, as I previously mentioned, there's guidance from staff. They're requesting comments on page 9 with regard to those items. And, of course, council, feel free to provide other comments as you see fit or necessary or recommendations. Reminder, next Tuesday evening, we will be looking at the budget in total, and that would be the time for actual approval and action. So with that, I will turn it over to Ms. Calloway. Ms. Calloway, thank you.
Actually, Mayor, I'll lead it off.
Mr. Collins, sorry.
Yeah, Scott Collins, City Manager, and Jane Calloway, our Finance Director and Acting Public Works Director, will also be presenting information as well, and we'll do it as a tag team. Thank you, council members, for making time, and community members for making time for this special budget discussion. As the mayor mentioned, it is a discussion and provides some direction, but ultimately the council would look to review and finalize the budget by the June 23rd, 2020 council meeting. So with that, I am going to share my screen if that's okay with everybody. I can figure out how to do this. Looks like it's working. Okay. So we're presenting the draft fiscal year 2021 budget and beyond. Don't need to remind everybody, and we know we've heard it ad nauseum for the last several months, that we are in a totally different world than we were in March with COVID-19. And it is affecting public health, it is affecting our local economy, and it is affecting our local government's finances. So that definitely colors our entire approach to the financial realm within the city. Moving on to the next slide, hopefully I can get this to move. So what we're going to do is present this budget to you and recognizing the current economic reality and then looking at the long term and how we can move forward. Just a bit of context setting. At the mid-year for the current fiscal year, we presented in February, late February, so right before the pandemic really spun up. There was a special council meeting where city council and the community received an update on the existing or current budget, as well as the 10-year financial forecast, which we've been doing for several years now with existing city staff resources. At that time, when we presented in February, we were projecting a $428,000 budget going into the next fiscal year, which grew up to about $1.4 million if no changes were made. Into fiscal year 28-29. So there was a structural issue prior to COVID-19, and we were working on long-term systemic solutions to that. And then we hit the pandemic in mid-March, declared a local emergency, as well as a short-term fiscal emergency plan, which council ratified in the middle of March. We are clearly in unprecedented times with the economic impacts to local, national, and the global markets and global economies, and just trying to do our best to wade our way through that, project into the future, and make cuts and other measures accordingly so we can continue to provide core services to our community. The April 28th, 2020 special council meeting, we presented the Rocks All Together Economic and Financial Recovery Plan. We were projections of deficits of about 4 to 5 million at that time, ranging from about 27 to 34% revenue losses for general fund for next year. When we put that in context of the overall budget looking forward into the 10-year forecast, we projected that becoming a long-term fiscal reality of about $2.5 million after the COVID-19 pandemic wore off and we started to see some recovery, that ongoing deficit was ratcheted up significantly, presenting us with not only short-term impacts we have to address, but long-term financial issues that we have to figure out how to move forward with. So Jen's going to take it from here, and then I'll jump back in a few minutes. Thank you, Jen.
Hi, good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for joining. As city manager was mentioning, we always go back and update our 10-year forecast when we do our budget, but we typically don't do such an extensive adjustment on the 10-year forecast, and that was all, of course, due to the COVID-19 pandemic. So we have a couple slides here to show you how we adjusted our revenue estimates and our expenditure estimates based on what we're seeing with COVID-19. We'll probably say this multiple times throughout the presentation, and I don't think I can say it enough, that these are incredibly fluid. What we knew even or expected last week or the week before has changed this week. So as we see, more people in town, as we expect to move into stage 3 of the reopening fairly soon, all of these could change again in another month, and we are committed to reviewing our budget extensively every month to see where we are, where we are landing with our revenues. But this slide is really to give you a comparison, and so you can see how we've made some adjustments to our main revenue sources that are impacted by COVID, TOT being the main source that's been impacted, and sales tax and property tax as well. You can see for TOT, we're projecting about a 48% loss in 2020-21. We have kept that number right about that 50% level for a couple of reasons. Initially, as hotels were reopening and there were more people in town, we were seeing reduced rates of about half. So even if you see full hotels, we aren't collecting the same amount of TOT if the rates are reduced. Also keeping in mind that the shelter-at-home orders are still in place, so travel at this point should still be restricted to essential travel only. Once the extra unemployment benefits run out in July, unless they're extended, we're thinking that that might change travel habits and spending habits as people go back to more of the regular unemployment rates and begin to look for jobs, and how quickly those jobs come back is still something that's unknown at this time. And then again, if the virus reemerges in the winter, fall, winter of next year, if there's no vaccine in place yet and businesses are expecting or having to close down again, we are kind of preparing for all of that in the projections for next year and holding steady with some of these revenue numbers, hoping that they are low, but again, there's a lot of uncertainty still that's out there. Our sales tax projections are down 22% for 2020-21 and another 12-13% for 21-22. This is really in recognition of a couple factors. First, that our consumer-to-consumer business sales tax is about 70% tourist-generated. A little bit more than 70%. So again, as the unemployment benefits return back to normal, if that might spur a recession or enhance a recessionary period, and if the virus again reemerges in this winter or fall period, we expect to have lower sales tax from both of those. And lastly, the state has deferred, as you're all aware, sales tax remittance for small businesses up to a year, up to 12 months. So while we should get that money, since it is a deferral, we've got some capacity built in there should businesses go, close or shutter up and go out of business. It's unclear how we would collect the sales tax in those cases or how it would be remitted, if in fact it is. So we've taken that into account. And then our property tax estimates, while they decreased for 2020-21, they do kind of remain fairly stagnant throughout the next 9 years of the forecast. We do expect property sales to slow down, so a portion of that is our transfer tax. We don't expect to see much of that received, or definitely a less amount of that received. And we expect property values to either remain steady or maybe go down a little bit because of the pandemic. So we based all of these projections in consultation with our sales tax consultants and their analysis, conversations, that are information received from the county, and then also historical data that we have based on revenues that were received during the recessionary period of 2008. And then, you know, indications from the tourism industry on what tourism activity was going to look like. We move down to our expenditures. Our salary and benefits show slight increases, show a decrease for 2020-21 due to the workforce reductions from not filling vacant positions and the employee layoffs that we had, and then some increases thereafter. Those increases are related to projected CalPERS increases for pension benefits, health care increases that we expect to come along, and then for any of the part-time employees that do remain that are at minimum wage, there's increased minimum wage rates. So we can move to the next slide, please. Thank you. These are the same slides. They just give you, instead of percentages, some number differences. So you can see what those percentages equate to. Again, the largest reductions being in TOT for next fiscal year, 2020-21, a 1.7 to 1.8 million-dollar reduction in our TOT, so almost half, followed by 1.6 million the following year. But we do start to gradually and expect to see tourism return, especially as we can start marketing and promoting Morro Bay. And by 2029, we're getting closer back to where we were projecting to be pre-COVID. Similarly for sales tax, we have some, you know, increased growth going, once we get into 24-25 period, and property tax, will increase slightly, as we go out through the period. Scott, next slide, please. And so this is the, 10-year forecast that you're all accustomed to seeing. We all know that we ended fiscal year 18-19 in a very positive position with $768,000 in revenues over expenditures. The council very prudently made the decision to allocate almost $500,000 of that money to prepay our Tier 2 and Tier 3 unfunded accrued liabilities for CalPERS. So that will have a significant impact moving forward. We do expect CalPERS costs to increase because of their market losses related to COVID-19. So having paid those off will help keep those costs down more than they would have been had we not done that. And also the lump sum payments that had been negotiated and the MOUs with our employees, if the city met certain revenue targets for property tax, sales tax, and TOT, which in fact we had met, the employees would share in that. So we did use a significant amount of those revenues over expenditures to make those payments. And then moving into 2020-21, at our August meeting, or at our April meeting, I'm sorry, we discussed having to allocate at least $1 million in reserves to help balance this fiscal year. With COVID hitting in the last quarter, there's not a lot of time to react and recover from how great of an impact COVID's had on our revenues. So we do anticipate using about $1 million. The proposed budget estimates about $1.2 million. We keep refining that and looking at our reports on a weekly basis. And I am thinking we'll be closer to the $1.1 to $1 million use of reserves when we close the year. And then for 2021, in addition to our operating expenditure reductions, our salary reductions, our workforce reductions, we do have programmed in about a $1.3 million use of reserves. As our revenues come in, and if they're higher than anticipated, obviously reserves, reliance on reserves will be reduced. But the important thing to note about this is that, you know, the city had positioned itself well to respond to a recession. We had a significant and stable amount of reserves on hand. A recession hits a little differently than a pandemic in that it's more gradual instead of an immediate shutdown of our economy. So we want to be very prudent and careful with our use of reserves to make sure that we have enough left in the piggy bank, if you will, to carry us through any recession that results from this and the duration of the pandemic if there's another surge of the virus in the fall. So next slide, please, Scott. As we look at the budget that's prepared, the draft budget and the proposed budget, we have a $12.8 million of operating expenditures in the general fund. This provides funding for our core services of police, public works, community development, fire, administrative services, and some minimal recreation services. And it's all funded through taxes and fees. Our special revenue funds, Measure Q and TBID, those are funded through the supplemental tax and then our tourist business assessment paid for by the vacation rentals and hotels. And that augments our police, fire, public safety services, as well as our street pavement management plan, and promotes Morro Bay as a tourist destination and destination of choice for people to come to. Our internal service funds are $3.4 million. Those are our funds that kind of work behind the scenes, our risk management fund for all of our insurance policies, our IT fund, there's project and capital accumulation funds, and then vehicle and facility replacement funds. And those are all funded by the various departments and the various other funding sources, so they're intra-fund transfers. Next slide, please, Scott. Our other funds of $1.6 million, this is a compilation of a variety of funds, our impact fees, our in-lieu fees, such as park in-lieu, housing in-lieu. We have some donation accounts in there, grant fees, our LTF, or local transportation funds. Our Cloisters Assessment District is included in this grouping. And a variety of other funds and the expenditures in the proposed budget, again, $1.6 million. These are all restricted funds that can only be used for certain purposes for which they were collected. Our enterprise funds, we all know water, sewer, our wastewater treatment plants, and our harbor fund. Budget expenditures, $24.8 million from those four enterprise funds. These are funded through user rates and rents. And then lastly, our capital projects. We have $52.3 million of capital projects in the proposed budget. This is almost over 90% planned progression on the city's wharf project at $47.7 million. Capital projects in general are funded by either the general fund, gas tax money, helps contribute towards our pavement management plan, user rates. In our case, particularly now that we have the WIFIA loan agreement signed, we intend on fronting project costs with our WIFIA loan in order to help keep our cash on hand available. And then as we move towards signing on an SRF loan in the future, we can also use Measure Q sales tax money, again, for the pavement management plan and our transit funds. And now I'll hand it back over to Scott to talk more about our Rock Solid Together financial plan that's incorporated in the budget.
Thank you, Jen. Yeah, so we took a comprehensive approach to not only the city finances, but also into the looking into the community. We won't focus too much on those things that helped assisted our community and our business community at this time, but previous presentations we talked about things like the expanding the utility discount program to those who have been laid off as a result of COVID-19, assisting our lodging partners through deferral of payment of transit occupancy tax, waiving of late fee penalties for everybody, not turning off water at this time if people can't make payments, and the like, and the Morbid Cares program to help our most vulnerable population. Very, very important things to do during an emergency and during a crisis, and we're glad we were able to do that. A lot of great ideas shared by community we were able to implement. But looking at the city component of the Rocks All Together, we have four pillars. There's employee compensation, there's operations, emergency reserves, and then federal, state, and community assistance. There's a long laundry list here, and I think Jen has spoken to most of those, but we did spring into action almost immediately in taking action to reduce our salaries. Those that did not require union negotiations, we did immediately, including city manager and directors, as well as city council waiving their stipends to the end of the year. Then we worked through our unrepresented employees, SEIU, and police. We are still working with our fire department. So virtually every employee is at least taking a 5% pay cut at this time through the end of the calendar year. We have frozen several positions or reallocated positions into other departments and funds. We've defunded a police position, assistant planner position, consolidated maintenance three position, and code enforcement. And unfortunately, despite all those efforts, we still did have to go through a round of layoffs of full-time employees, including engineer, public works superintendent, admin tech position, recreation supervisor, and then part-time office assistant, as well as 70 part-time recreation employees, as we can't, in many ways, can't provide the recreation services that we'd like to at this time with COVID-19 in play. In addition, we looked at reducing non-personnel expenditures as much as we could, upwards of $600,000. Those include no general fund contribution to tourism, no allocation of council bequests, no travel outside of San Luis Obispo County unless safety mandated, limited training budgets, bare minimum supply budgets, and looking at our contracts very closely, and no funding of equipment and vehicle replacement schedules. Obviously, things that you can do on a temporary basis, you can't rely on these forever, but these are important things to do, and just literally coming over every expense, and the city manager and finance director having to approve virtually everything at this time. As Jen mentioned, we did and do intend to use our reserves responsibly. We've been benefited by good decision making in the city in the past to withhold funds and put them in the bank, as it were, and be able to stock away 3 months of operation reserves for situations just like the one we're in. And we do see this as a slow climb out, and we will need to turn to reserves both this year, next year, and potentially the year after. So we have to be very careful how we use those. We do project those going pretty low at the end of next year. With the vacancy freezes, as well as the reductions in overall number of employees with layoffs, there will be service reductions and service impacts. We did our best to minimize those as much as possible in considering the priorities that have been expressed through council meetings, through surveys, through community forums. We understand public safety to be a key priority, and so we did our best to preserve layoffs or not to do layoffs in those places. We, again, would consider most of these to be short-term reductions in nature, and we have to think about long-term how we can create a sustainable workforce and service array for our community as the community relies upon those services for their quality of life. So again, we looked at four pillars. We talked about the waiver of stipends, the salary concessions, and the like for the pillar one. Pillar two is prioritization of operations and looking at our expenditures very closely, which we have done. And good to note that our mental marketing contract for tourism has been modified, so there's no monthly retainer fees. We've altered our chamber contract, so there's no visitor center services being paid for at this time. The city attorney has volunteered cost reductions and savings, I think in the amount of about $17,000 or $18,000. The wharf program manager has reduced his hourly rate by 10%, and other consultants are doing the same. And we're freezing expenditures everywhere we can. And as I mentioned, we reviewed and prioritized services for the layoffs that we conducted already. Pillar three is the emergency reserves. This kind of gives you an idea of where we're at and in terms of that $3.4 million amount, and then looking at sort of optimistic, moderate, and worst case scenarios where we'll end up at the end of next year. And even under a moderate scenario, we may be extinguishing our reserves. So we have to be very, very careful. And that's why we recommend having almost monthly updates to council on our budget moving forward. And last but not least is the pillar four, which is looking at the state and federal assistance and also, you know, community discussion. The CARES Act at this point still does not apply to Morro Bay, as there was a 500,000 population caps established. However, the state did receive money for local government. They do have a $54+ billion deficit projected for next year. There is discussions about releasing some of those funds to cities. It will be small amounts, of course, because there are over 400 cities in California. And we're still working with our congressional representatives to push forward another stimulus bill that could have direct revenues to cities. Of course, consider community input on potential local revenue enhancements. So we'll now turn back to Jen to run through some of the expenditures and revenues by fund, and then we can get into the discussion component of tonight or this afternoon. Ready, Jen?
Yep, thank you. And Scott, these kind of build on each other, so you'll have to keep tabbing through. This is what's included in the proposed budget compared to prior year's actuals and estimated. You can see that a significant reduction in the general fund or the city, total city funds, in the general fund. That's mostly due to our reduced salary and benefits. Our enterprise funds have increased slightly because we have some planned capital projects in there. Again, the capital projects component is mostly made up of our wharf, and then our internal service funds stay fairly stable. So in total, the proposed budget is $52.3 million in expenditures citywide. Next slide, please, Scott. Our general fund, this is a breakdown of the revenues by type. We have our sales tax at $1.7 million, our property tax at $3.3 million, VLF backfill is just below $1 million, and then our TOT, you can see the big difference from the prior years in that down to $1.8 million. And then, Scott, the next slide, please. General fund revenues, or general fund expenditures by category. Again, if you look at that bottom blue bar there, even though the percentage of total budget is higher by dollar amount, salary and benefits are down quite a bit from prior years, as are our operating expenditures, about $600,000 less than the prior year. And you can see there's no equipment replacement money, no capital outlay, debt service we don't have any control over. We have to pay that. That's for the solar installation loan that we have, and pretty minimal supplies as compared to that in prior years. And the next slide, please. When you look at expenditures by department, you can see how they compare. Our police department expenditures are pretty close with that of a couple years ago. Fire expenditures have been reduced with some reduction in the reserve program, and the seasonals that they have on board. Our public works department has been reduced significantly, almost $200,000 expenditures, again, from staffing, some reallocations that we've made, and reduced operational services and contract services. And then our city administration, which is our city attorney, city manager, clerk, HR, and finance department, have been reduced significantly with not only workforce reductions and employee layoffs, but also eliminating basically all contract and anything discretionary out of the budget for there. And then recreation reduced due to the inability to provide recreational services at this point to the extent that we traditionally do. So when we take all this into account and consideration, we go back to thinking about our emergency reserves and how they're operating. Scott, if you go to the next slide, we can review those. Thank you. If you look at the kind of use of our reserves over the last 5 to 6 year period, you can see they spike up a little bit. In 2017-18, we paid off our fireside fund. We used reserves to do that. That saved about $50,000 in interest payments that we would have made to the state had we not done that in advance. And then last year had significant revenues over expenditures, as we discussed, but we did use that money to, again, prepay or pay off our Tier 2 and Tier 3 PERS unfunded accrued liabilities, or UALs, and then our lump sum payments to employees that were committed and previously negotiated. So that brought our reserve levels down when you consider that we have $1.2 million included in our budget as estimated use to help mitigate the last quarter impacts of COVID-19. And then for next year, looking at $1.3 million use of reserves for COVID-19 shortfall. So that will get us close to about $1 million left in our reserve balance, which is a fairly low amount if there's a recession period that will last for several years. So we need to work on reducing our use of reserves in the next fiscal year, hopefully use less than projected this fiscal year, and rebuilding those reserves up so we have some resiliency in the general fund. When we move beyond that, Scott, next slide, please. Our Measure Q budget, it is a general tax measure. However, by resolution, it's allocated towards public safety, streets, and storm drains. Typically, the Measure Q budget has funded the debt service at the fire station, some fire equipment, and provided staffing for the fourth firefighter to maintain four staff per shift, which helps with our insurance rating. For police, the Measure Q budget is providing funding for some equipment needs and then pays for our bomb, gang, and drug task force with the sheriff. We also have $325,000 programmed in Measure Q for pavement management. It was the recommendation of the committee when they reviewed this in April and May to keep that money appropriated for pavement management. However, keep it on hold or in abeyance, if you will. We won't do any pavement work associated with this until spring of next year, when we can assure that the revenues are received as we are projecting. If there's a shortfall of revenues, we obviously won't have the money to continue with the pavement plan, or if there's other needs that arise from a public safety perspective, the committee wanted the ability to recommend reappropriating money to offset public safety needs as they were prioritizing that for next year. We did ask the committee to approve a $40,000 appropriation to purchase asphalt material. This will help us keep our in-house staff, consolidating maintenance crew on hand to complete some road maintenance and patchwork that we typically do throughout the year and is funded in the general fund. This is important to note that we want to maintain that road maintenance work with use of these discretionary funds, because it helps maintain our maintenance of effort, which qualifies us for the SB1 gas tax money. Which is a little bit circular there, but important and something we were watching to make sure we did maintain that. In addition, and it's included in the proposed budget, the Measure Q committee or the CFAP committee in May 19th, when they reviewed the budget, did recommend and agree to provide up to $12,000 of funding across between this fiscal year and next fiscal year to fund an overlap position. As you all know, we have a vacant position in our police department that we've chosen to keep vacant at this time due to the budget impacts. We have another officer that is retiring second week of July, has provided retirement notice. So this funding would go towards bringing a officer on board, starting them through the FTO field training program, and by the time the other officer retires in July, have this new officer more ready to be on his own or her own quicker. So there's $12,000 that we've allocated to help offset those costs in that overfill position, and the CFAP committee did agree to that. The CFAP committee, also want to note, they only reviewed this year the Measure Q budget. That was in April, and then in May received the general fund budget. In the past, we've provided the full budget document to the CFAP committee, or at least last year we did, due to the timing of compiling this budget and refining it, given all the changes that are occurring on a weekly basis. The committee did not get a chance to review anything other than Measure Q or the general fund. So just wanted to point that out. However, they did review and approve both of those and recommend Measure Q and general fund as they were being proposed. Scott, next slide, please. Our tourism budget, again, that's a special revenue fund. Our tourism budget is funded through assessments that are paid for by the hotels and the vacation rentals, 3% assessment. Typically, the assessments run about $830,000 to $850,000. This year, we are programming assessments of $550,000, substantial reduction from prior years. Again, while we monitor what the tourist activity is going to look like, we do think it will resume back up. There's some indication from the tourism industry that people will be traveling differently. There'll be more reliance on RV camping, you know, whether it's in vans or Airstreams or those kind of things, an environment that they can feel like they can control more and control the cleanliness more. So that will have an impact on our bid assessments that are received and our TOT. And again, at this point, we cannot be actively marketing our city as a tourist destination due to the shelter at home orders that are still in effect, and any deterrence from that might impact some future reimbursements under the CARES Act or other stimulus money. So we don't want to jeopardize that. So having said that, we've only programmed or appropriating $385,000 of those assessments. That is mostly from the defunding of our tourism manager position and a part-time administrative assistant. Both of those positions were laid off, understanding the current environment that we're in. We have reduced expenditures allocated towards marketing and public relations and community event support until we see further what that activity can look like in the future. So for the immediate time, the city manager will be overseeing the remaining part-time position that's in the tourism department and overseeing the marketing piece of it. I do intend to have some outreach with stakeholders on how to best move forward once we're able to reopen and remarket our city. There is no general fund contribution to our TBID fund. If you recall in prior years, there's always been a general fund contribution that we were ratcheting down. This year it's been eliminated completely. And we have intentionally left large amounts in reserves here, approximately $300,000. Between the amount that was already in their accumulation fund and then assessments over expenditures program for 2020-21. And this is to help with any losses that are experienced. So if tourism activity does not come back as we expect, if our revenues are over-optimistic, We want to have some money left in the piggy bank there that we can still rely on to market our city and promote our city when the time is right to do so. Next slide, please, Scott. This is our internal service funds. I would note that the total fund line at the bottom is not just for these, it's all city funds, so I apologize for that. We have $1.3 million allocated from our emergency reserves, which we've talked a little bit about. We are programming about $20,000 for 2020-21 compensable leave. That's our accrued balances that employees have and what we estimate from some of our workforce reductions that we will make payouts for with employees that are separating from the city. Our facility maintenance fund, that is typically funded with some of our rental income. We've asked to appropriate $25,000 to complete some minimum facilities work. At this point, with some of our staffing reductions, there's not a lot planned until we move further in the year and see how our revenues are trending. And then we have less discretion over our risk management and IT funds. We have our risk management is our insurance policies, so we don't have a lot of ability to control what those projected costs will be. And then our IT fund is all of our memberships or our program fees for like our finance system and all of the IT needs that we have in the city. Next slide, please, Scott. This is a summary of our other funds. Again, these are all restricted use funds. We've tried to transition our capital projects that we are doing outside of the wharf and any other projects that we could think of and rely on some of these restricted funds to help bridge the gap until we understand more what is going to happen with the economy from COVID. So, for example, we have parking in lieu fee money, $22,000. That is going to go, or parking lieu fee to help offset our Tidelands pocket park construction. So that's an alternative revenue source from our general fund. We are allocating about $55,000 in the lower cost visitor accommodation fund. These are impact fees or funds paid to help support lower cost visitor accommodations. If we don't use them, we do need to give them back to those that have paid them. This money is being programmed to help administer a waterfront RV camping program. So should council choose not to move forward with that, we would have to change that in the proposed budget. And then our government impact fees this year is helping with the construction of our security features in the public services building and recreation building and senior center. We're able to charge staff time to those programs as well since we're doing that internally. And again, that helps to reduce the reliance on the general fund as a short-term mitigation measure. Next slide, please. Talk a little bit about our enterprise funds here quickly. Our water enterprise fund, the operating expenditures, $7.5 million. That's primarily 46% is made up of a transfer out to the accumulation fund for capital. Our next slides, please. Our sewer enterprise fund at $9.2 million. And again, a substantial portion of that at 62% is being transferred to our accumulation fund. In the future, that will be used to pay the debt service for the wharf project in future years. Next slide, our wastewater treatment plant fund. This is the joint venture that's with Cayucas, estimated at $2.7 million. We, the city of Morro Bay, pay about 75% of the operating costs each year, and Cayucas pays 25%. So as the Cayucas plant becomes ready and moves on board and they don't use this facility, we'll be adjusting this budget as we move forward. Next slide, please. So our water and sewer accumulation funds, as I mentioned earlier in the presentation, we have opted and are including in the proposed budget to use our WIFIA financing to fund the wharf construction in next year and moving forward. We've already started to submit reimbursement requests to WIFIA at this point, and that helps from a cash flow perspective. It keeps cash in our bank accounts, and then it will provide additional options for the council in moving forward, either capital projects or, you know, there's a variety of options that we could move forward with that. So in total, we're projecting to end fiscal year 2021 with about $22 million between the water and sewer accumulation funds, and that is because we're not going to allocate cash on hand to fund those projects other than a cash flow perspective until the reimbursements come in. We also have $10 million outstanding in our SRF planning loan that we need to receive yet, so that will even increase our accumulation funds beyond the $22 million. Next slide, please. Our Harbor Enterprise Fund, $1.9 million in planned expenditures. The Harbor Fund has been impacted by COVID-19 as well, and in fact, I didn't mention that with our water and sewer funds. With the closure of our hotels and our restaurants, the rates that we received, user rates in the month of March, were lower than they were in the prior year. We're monitoring that very closely to see how that impacts the operating funds. Of course, our workforce reductions did have some cost savings to the enterprise funds, water and sewer, as we reallocated positions, and we did lay off one of our account clerks that does utility billing. So there were savings that we achieved from that. However, we will be monitoring our revenues coming in very closely. Harbor Enterprise run the same in that their revenues are primarily generated from the ground leases. There's minimum rents that are expected to be collected. Those have been deferred at this point. We haven't made any determination on any kind of forgiveness of that. As you all know, the Harbor Enterprise Fund has been short on cash for a while and unable to meet infrastructure needs. That plays into any conversation about rent deferral or forgiveness. But right now we're projecting and have included in this budget the typical minimum rents with the programmed cost of living increase. But we do expect to have anything beyond minimum rents to be lower than in prior years due to either shops closing or having been closed for such an extensive period of time. And our Harbor Accumulation Fund, next slide please, Scott. We have one capital project budgeted in the proposed budget. That is $10,000 set aside for any repairs that may be needed to the ice machine. Other than that, the accumulation fund is being held as is to make up for any revenue shortfalls that we experience this year and next year due to the storefronts being closed down. And then lastly, I'm going to talk a little bit about our capital projects that are programmed and our overall city fund balance reserves. So for our capital improvement program, we did make an attempt to prioritize capital projects that could be funded in non-general fund monies. So we have our streets program at $837,000. That is primarily our pavement management plan that will be held in abeyance again or held off until next spring, and we can ensure that we've received the revenues that we're projecting to receive. That Measure Q contribution is combined with SB1 money to do an overall complete pavement project. We've got $56,000 in our Parks and Creek capital improvement program, $250,000 in our public facilities program. Next slide, Scott. About $3.1 million in infrastructure for our water system. This includes some reskinning of our water tanks and some necessary infrastructure improvements for the membrane replacements and desal plants. $47.7 million in our sewer projects. It's predominantly the wharf, and then there's the completion of the one water projects for the sewer lines that were started this fiscal year. $10,000, as I mentioned, for our harbor, and that is for the ice machine if there's repairs needed for that. And $270,000 for transit, that's to purchase one new trolley bus. There's some signage, and then the transit hub remodel up at City Park. And then the next slide, please, Scott. Overall, I thought this would be an important slide to share. This is out of the proposed budget on page B12, and this is a summary of our overall fund balance in the city, our overall cash balances in the city. COVID-19 has impacted the city quite hard, being a tourist destination and really relying on tourism as our primary revenue drivers. So we do expect to experience a lot of pain, if you will, from that. However, it's important to keep in mind that planning for future years is important. We do have good cash flow to help us weather the storm and get to a better place. We need to have important conversations about, you know, additional revenue options, expenditure reductions, service priorities. But overall, we are expecting to end fiscal year 2020-21 with $31.5 million in cash. So it's a substantial amount of cash to help us get through the impacts of COVID-19 and come up with a long-term sustainability plan that will, you know, structurally balance our budget for years to come. And then Scott's going to talk about the next few slides and conclude the presentation, but I do want to thank everybody. The budget process is one that our whole city team comes together to complete, and that's on the good years. And now we're in a pandemic and facing, you know, unprecedented times where we've had employees working from home, and a lot of emotion going on with having to do layoffs and workforce reductions. And our entire city team contributed to putting together a draft budget with numbers that we feel comfortable with that truly reflect the work that each of the departments are doing and the services that they're providing to the community. So a lot of the managers and department heads, everybody is on this call, and I just really want to thank them for all the work that they did in getting this document together and on time. So Scott, you want to conclude?
Well said, Jen, and I definitely echo those comments, as well as the community members who've participated either formally or informally through public comment and or through the city manager's roundtable, through the Citizen Finance Advisory Committee, through emails, through phone calls to provide input and support, and it's been tremendous. And we do definitely see a brighter horizon out there, and it's only by virtue of us working together to get there, that it'll happen. So with that in mind, we're looking to deal with sort of the short term, as Jen mentioned, but also the long term. We're all part of an ecosystem where we rely upon each other. We provide core services to the community to help improve their quality of life, and we in turn rely upon them and the business community for our wherewithal and survival and thriving. So it's definitely a team effort to get there. And so that's the point of this slide. And I think we've reiterated that time and time again. I've also heard the stories out in the community of folks coming together to help each other out. And that's what it's going to take. As far as some of the longer term sustainability and transformational change options, as was mentioned before, I did form a roundtable group earlier in May, consisting of Homer Alexander, Jeff Eccles, Jen Ford, Mary Haas Hay, Walter Heath, John Solu, and Susan Stewart. A pretty good representation of our community, you know, folks who have been prior business owners or current business owners, folks who have a good pulse of the community, and sat down with them for several meetings to discuss what we're presenting today, as well as other options, and really let them brainstorm and kick around ideas and make recommendations to myself and the city council, And some of those measures here on the slide were recommended by this group. Again, understanding that even prior to COVID-19, we did have some structural issues, and those have only been made worse by COVID-19. So we heard the potential for a sales tax measure on the November ballot. There was support from the group on that, considering that it could provide a boost of about $2 million or more on each year moving forward. As Jen mentioned, sales tax, at least the consumer side of things, is primarily paid for by non-residents. About 70% is the number that our HDL sales tax consultant derived by looking at receipts and other methods to make that determination. And that does square with some of the other cities in our county that have similar numbers. There was also discussion about sale of properties, and those are expressed a bit more detail within the staff report, and as has been mentioned by public commenters, and is correct, those are, if you sell a property, it's one-time influx of cash, and that's it. Those properties could be maintained by the city and rented and having a more prolonged revenue stream, but then, of course, there are the costs of maintaining those assets that may reduce that overall revenue amount, or at least the net amount to the city. So definitely worthy of discussion with council. We heard about the RV waterfront camping idea, which we are in discussions with Coastal Commission about. They are trying to help cities as they weather the storm from COVID-19 and looking at things like that, or outdoor dining in the waterfront area. And they appear to be supportive, but we need to get clearance from them, and would not require a coastal development permit for the time being, which allows us to move more quickly. We did hear the discussion about paid parking, and maybe that's a misnomer. It's really about parking management, which we currently don't have at this time. There really is no parking regulations other than, you know, the red zones and our handicap parking. But by and large, it's a free-for-all system, and maybe that works and maybe it doesn't. But there has been discussions in the past. Studies have been completed. Most recently, I think 2007, which was mentioned by one of our commenters today. That study determined at that time there really weren't significant parking impacts except for a few blocks in the waterfront area and during peak season and on the weekends. So very specific. And based on those results, the council decided not to move forward, which was probably wise given what the results of the survey said. That was 13 years ago. We have TBID that's been put in place, so you have a lot more visitors annually compared to 2007. And potentially a different dynamic with our parking. We've heard from business owners concerned that people park in front of their businesses and sit there all day, and their cars sit there all day, and you're not seeing the turnover you'd like to see for retail operations. A parking system, if done well, could pay for itself, as well as improvements to the overall parking system, as well as improvements to the adjacent areas like the streets, landscaping, sidewalks, et cetera, to help beautify the area. That's what a well-run system could provide, but it does require a study ahead of time to determine if there's a true need before moving further into the process, and also would require a coastal development permit. And it was discussed in previous council meetings, a microloan program. We did look at this a bit more, and it determined we, as city staff, could not oversee such a program, but there are cities that you turn to their local banks to administer programs like this. So it could be done in that format. We would just want to get some guidance from council. It concludes our remarks today. And the last slide, again, points to that we are in this together for the local relief and recovery plan and the city manager's roundtable. And their recommendations are certainly part of that. But there's been a lot of discussion outside of that, including surveys and public comments and the council meetings, where we've heard a lot of good input and hopefully can move forward with some of these measures if it makes sense to the council. So with that, we'll turn it over to council for any questions or discussion.
Thank you, Scott and Jen, for the very comprehensive report. Also for your presentation today. And the backup document that is the draft budget, very lengthy document, but as always, very comprehensive, and we appreciate getting all of that information. So with that, council members, I'm going to open it up first for just questions. please. And then after that, if we could just have some generic discussion individually on the items that staff has asked us to weigh in on for this this current budget period. So with that, I will start, if I could, with Councilmember Davis, sir. Questions?
Thank you. I do have a few questions. But first, of course, I want to say thank you for a beautiful presentation. Not only the PowerPoint slides today, but the whole budget document that that went along with it. It lists who we are, what we do, why we do it. It's a great team effort of the whole staff putting it together. So just thank you all very much for that. You answered a lot of my questions in your presentation, as well as questions that I sent you before before the meeting, and you responded to those. But I want to follow up a little bit regarding the parking management. Pismo Beach, I believe, has instituted a parking management plan, and the chamber told us in their report a couple of weeks ago that they do generate net revenue, and they do have Coastal Commission approval of that plan. So I'm wondering if we have had conversations with Jim Lewis, or do we have any guidance from Pismo?
Yes, great question, Councilmember. Talked extensively with Mr. Lewis and Mr. Johnson in SLO. Obviously, they don't have to contend with the Coastal Commission there, but similar, just trying to get insights on parking management, and also my experience in Santa Cruz being a coastal community and having a parking management system in a parking district for downtown. So pretty good, based on that, pretty good background on the issue. Pismo was very clear that you approach parking management for that purpose, and if there are ancillary spinoff revenues, that you're careful with those, that they are used to support the system and, of course, adjacent infrastructure that is connected to the parking makes sense. And that could include, obviously, the staffing for that, whether it's contracted or not. The enforcement piece, the mechanisms, the meters, the toll systems and parking structures, if those are warranted, that all is part and parcel of it. And again, I think it's some of the responses I've given you. You look at parking management to do a number of things. It should assist you in economic vitality. If you don't have turnover in parking, it can create stagnation. And you want to use the market forces to help assist you in that. It should pay for itself. And if there are spinoff revenues, that those should be used to invest back into the system and support adjacent activity. And I think that is what Pismo has been successful in doing. It has taken them quite some time to get there, a lot of different iterations. Yes, they did get approval from Coastal Commission, but they still had to go through that process. So that is... that's just something we have to factor in. And I think with Coastal Commission, you just need to make the case that your efforts aren't abridging coastal access. But there are plenty of examples of cities that I've already mentioned, and many others that have implemented parking in the coastal zones and has not affected coastal access, and has gotten approval. But again, those are steps in the process you do need to go through. You can't implement it without their input.
Okay. And then related to that is outdoor dining, using public spaces on the waterfront to help support our restaurants. I wonder where we are in discussions with the Coastal Commission on that. And I just want to point out that this is a survival issue, I think, for some of our restaurants. And I'll use the Galley, for example. They've been reduced to half the number of tables. And that's not a sustainable model for David and Aglaya to continue going forward with their business. And they have 40 full-time employees. So it's more than just the restaurant. It's 40 households. And I would impress upon the Coastal Commission to take a long-term view. Yes, they do promote coastal access, but coastal access isn't only driving up to the waterfront and looking at it. It is also the support facilities that support that access, and restaurants are a very critical part of that. If you don't have restaurants and you don't have food, then tourists aren't going to come to the waterfront. So I wonder where we are in discussions with Coastal Commission staff on that.
Yes, good question. We are in discussion with them both about the outdoor dining and the RV parking program, and all signs point towards progress and understanding of those very, very key points, which we have made, impressed upon them, and several other coastal cities have made the similar request to the Coastal Commission regarding outdoor dining. So I think we may be successful in that effort. Scott Graham has submitted information to the Santa Cruz office that represents our area. And we anticipate hearing back this week from them. And if Scott, if there's anything else to add to that, please do it this time.
Sure. I mean, I've had ongoing conversations with them, both, you know, verbally and via email, you know, regarding, you know, what the process would look like. And that's what we're trying to get back from them right now is what kind of process is would this be in, and they haven't come to a determination about how they would expand the outdoor seating for our lease site areas, because all those are public access ways. And that was one of the things they were working on, and hopefully we're going to have a conversation later this week with them about that. The other item that they were supportive of and said they'd be willing to potentially issue waivers for was if we were interested in closing down a portion of the Embarcadero, like making it one way or something like that, and putting seating out there and expanding opportunities for pedestrians to walk so you can social distance properly, you know, when we're busy, that type of thing. And they were really supportive of that. But on that side of things, their business community didn't really want that. They were concerned about, you know, what impact that would have to people's ability to come to their shops or receive deliveries and things like that. So, you know, kind of got that. That's in pause right now. And we did take a look at, and I did talk to Coastal about also sort of re-envisioning what those dead end street ends would look like. And maybe we could make those areas into seating opportunities or something along those, and pop-up market type things, that type of thing. And Coastal was receptive to that as well. But we need to, you know, touch back with our business community down on the waterfront to see, you know, what they want us to do, and also find out where Coastal is so they can be fully informed whether they're able to put out, you know, tables and things like that on the lease sites in some of those public areas.
Thank you very much. Okay. On the property sales, the rental house on Dune Street, do we have any idea of what the monthly rental value of that is?
We don't have a good feel on that because the market is shifting quite a bit. We did a market analysis several months ago, and we were looking to rent to city employees at least to offer that at market rate like we've done in the past. And I think it clocked in at about $2,000 right before COVID-19. And we put that out to our city employees, and there was no interest. I think that probably demonstrates potentially that it's above market. So we probably could get somewhere around $1,700-$1,800 a month for that. One thing to note on that property is that we anticipate there will be capital needs in the near future, whether it's the roof or some structural issues. So that's something that we sort of keep in mind, like we may be paying more or paying equal amounts of in upgrades as we are in receiving revenues. So that's definitely one consideration we have.
Okay. And another piece of property that you listed that looks interesting is an R1 lot at the corner of Downing and Bolton up in the Harbor Tract. I drove by and looked at that, and it looks like a very attractive property. Do we have any idea what the value of that is?
I don't, but maybe Scott or Jen has an idea, or Rob potentially. Anyone?
I think Scott, Rob is on the call too, and he had done analysis, and I think he said maybe between 600,000, around that mark, Scott.
Rob, that's correct. Based on this was based on comparable sales pre-COVID, so it is a larger lot than the rest of them in the neighborhood. Based on raw land value, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of 600,000, maybe as high as 700,000.
And the city has no planned use for that?
The use was, from what I understand, was a potential frontage road should the Tri-W lot within the city develop. It would be another point of access to that property. The primary access would be Morro Bay Boulevard, and then there would be secondary access through construction of this frontage road. So that was, you know, almost 30 years ago was the plan. We haven't seen anything come forward on that property.
Okay. And as regards a frontage road, as I recall, one of the reasons that we did not choose the east side alignment for the pipeline was all of those little dry water areas that
yes, those areas that are would be probably considered waters of the state of California would be a environmental challenge to construct a roadway across.
Okay. And a question about the speed survey. The estimated cost is about $20,000. And I guess the question is, why do we need a speed survey?
The law requires that to enforce speed limits on our non-local or non-prima facie streets. So prima facie streets would be like residential neighborhoods at 25 miles an hour, school zones at 25 miles an hour, railroad crossings and blind intersections at 15 miles an hour. Those can be enforced without a speed survey, but anything on our collector or arterial street system requires that we determine what the speed a reasonable person would drive that at. So the 85th percentile rule, we've all heard that. So you survey at least 100 cars free-flowing and determine what that speed limit is, and it can be posted and enforced. Otherwise, there can be no enforcement of speed limits besides the basic speed law where you have to drive. You can only drive as fast as conditions will allow.
Okay, so, all right.
Those speed surveys are good to up to 10 years. So yeah. As long as conditions don't change, you only have to do those once every 10 years. Ours expired in 2019.
Okay. And regarding a potential sales tax, do we know if other cities in our county are also seeking sales tax measures and in what amount?
Yes. I think every city is considering a measure. PISMO Council has already approved moving forward with a transit occupancy tax increase to be placed on the ballot for consideration by their community. I believe every other city is looking at a sales tax. I think SLO is looking to continue an existing one that would sunset and then adding another 0.5 on top. And then I believe all the other cities are considering a 1 cent. But they have not, nobody has formally adopted that yet other than PISMO with the TOT to be placed on the ballot.
Okay, so we would not be the only ones seeking a sales tax.
Correct.
Okay. And I guess that's all my questions. I want to thank you very much for the work you've done to reach out to this.
Thank you, Councilmember Davis. Let's go to Councilmember Heller. Sir, questions?
Yes, thank you, Mayor. Great report, Scott and Jen. Enormous amount of work I know went into this. A lot of input from CFAC, just hundreds of hours by lots of people in the community, including the work group, which I commend you for putting together. I do have a list of questions. I know the council's goal is to achieve fiscal sustainability. In your opinion, assuming your projections are correct here, will these result in fiscal sustainability 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 2 years? I mean, what are your thoughts about whether or not we're going to meet that goal or not?
That's the $1 million question, or maybe $15 million question at this time. We believe there is an array of options here, both in what council's already done in terms of expenditure reduction, and on the converse side, there are options on the revenue side that can create that long-term sustainability. I also think that's joined with the economic development, moderate economic development in our community. Without changing the character of who we are, that there are opportunities for that. And I think when you couple the expense reductions, a couple of these revenue enhancement options and economic development, you can create that path towards long-term sustainability. And I think that existed prior to COVID-19. It's just been made more acute because of those impacts. But my answer is yes. It's obviously picking the right mixture. You don't want to overwhelm your community with a lot of requests on their part, because they are struggling, as the callers have mentioned. So it's trying to find the right mixture.
Okay. Fair enough. So obviously we have a current list of expense reductions and possible revenue enhancements. Do you plan on having financial triggers in place which will dictate implementation of corrective actions if needed?
I would say we have triggers specifically in mind, Councilmember Heller, but we definitely have the sort of that gut check, and I think that's where the monthly check-ins with council will go a long way. We'll be learning together. As Jen has mentioned, this is going to be one of the more interesting and need for flexibility budget years we've ever had. In the case that we have maybe a second wind of COVID-19 in the winter, in the fall winter, we have to be prepared to move quickly for that. So yes, we can. There are other things we can do. It's just you sort of have to balance that with the long term viability of your organization, which we're trying to balance that with the cash on hand to get through without decimating the organization and the services our community relies upon. So I think those monthly check-ins are going to be critical to, okay, where are we today? Where are we today? What changes need to be made to adjust in either direction?
Okay. In that vein, have you prepared a list of possible additional layoffs if necessary?
We have not put together another list of layoffs, but I would say that based on the actions already taken by council, the next level would likely impact those core functions like police and fire, and we've tried to do everything we can to avoid that. Though the cuts we have made are very impactful to those, whether it's tourism, whether it's public works, our front office here, harbor, and virtually every department has been impacted, and there will be service reductions or delays as a result. But the next level would likely require cuts in those priority departments.
Okay. Next question is this: the numbers that you've presented today, which are very thorough, they're assuming no bailout money from any other level of government. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. At this time, we're not projecting those. So that's not stopping us and all the council members here. I know you've all reached out to assist, in working with our state and federal partners. But yeah, at this time, we are not projecting use of that yet.
Okay. And then we're also assuming in this current projection here that the CalPERS investment return will be in the 7% range. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. We do not try to anticipate what the moves will be related to the financial issues down at up at the PERS group. You know, there were massive hits in the beginning of COVID-19. They were looking at $60 to $75 million losses, $1 billion losses, I should say. And I think most of that has been made up. But as you mentioned, their discount rate is at 7%, or working towards 7%, and it's highly unlikely that they'll achieve that this year. And thusly, they likely will have to make moves. And the way they typically do that is it's a couple years down the road. So we anticipate that there will be an impact. We just don't know what it would be. And furthermore, with less employees paying into it, they have to make that up somehow. So likely we'll experience some additional increases based on that. So that's something we are considering, but we haven't baked anything into it because we just don't know what that number would be.
Okay. And then, you know, I've lost track of the full cost recovery in the fee department. Can you tell me again what's going into effect and when as far as the fee increases?
Yes, sir. I'll let
Sorry, I just can't keep track of it.
Yeah, I know.
Sorry.
There's a lot going on.
so I'll tackle that one, Councilmember.
Thank you.
We came back about a month ago with our fee update that'll go into effect July 1. That was a phased-in approach. We deferred the phase-in to full cost recovery based on the study we did, understanding the impacts of COVID to our community members. We're going to be back in September with an update to our impact fees. And those are the ones that developers pay if they, you know, can't to contribute towards fire and police and general tax services. So we'll bring those back in September and then revisit our overall fee schedule again next spring. Would note that to the extent we reopen and provide recreation services, we'll be bringing those forward to be full cost recovery in the areas that we can, just in order to be able to provide those services given you know what's going on right now and the layoffs we've had to do in that department.
Okay, thank you for that. I wrote it down. Hopefully I will not lose the information to next time I ask you for it. Let's see here. I know how busy you are. Have you given any thought to a conceptual consolidation of facilities plan for city administration and other city services, whereby working from home might be considered a new normal and you might need a smaller physical footprint, which might free up real estate that we own that could be leased or sold?
We haven't gotten down to specifics on that. I think we're sort of assessing how prolonged the COVID impact will be. And I think when it levels off, that's certainly a consideration. As we move into reopening, I think we will preserve as much of the work from home as we can, just to keep things as safe as possible here. But as far as we don't know where we're going to land on the number of FTE. I think that's sort of what you got to work from if you're going to consolidate into a less number of facilities, but that is definitely something down the road that I think we should consider.
Okay. In terms of selling real estate, those assets, is the goal to, if we sold real estate, would the goal be to balance the general fund, or would that money go into the emergency reserve fund for the general fund, or what are your thoughts about what you would do with that revenue if we decide to sell something?
I believe it could be both of those. It could backfill some of the reductions and or be placed in the emergency reserves to sort of build that up again. Jen may have an additional perspective on that, but that's typically what you would do. Or if you had, you know, other investment opportunities the city wanted to move towards, those monies could be applied there. So Jen, anything to add to that?
Yeah, I would just say that we do have a revenue policy. The city by resolution adopted an expenditure and revenue policy, and per that policy, one-time revenue such as those generated from the sale of properties can only be used for one-time expenditures or to fill reserves. So In this case, realizing how much money we're expecting to use from our emergency reserves, our first recommendation would be to backfill those emergency reserves to bring them back up to our target minimum or target funding levels.
Okay, great. There's a note either in the staff report or a previous report about a possible $50 annual property tax measure for the Harbor Fund. Is that discussion off the table? I know you had mentioned there was less than 50% support for it, but I'm wondering, that survey was taken a while ago, and the Harbor Fund obviously is a great asset. I mean, the harbor's a great asset for us. Is it possible that we could put something on the ballot in November? What would be the downside to doing that, even if it failed?
Great question. We did look at that again, and I think those numbers in the community survey done in the fall of last year were indicative of that. I think there would be a lot of work needed to be done to sort of explain to the general community what the Harbor Fund is and sort of how it operates and functions. I mean, we have an exceptional Harbor Advisory Board and a great Harbor Department, and I think we've all been talking about this, at least as a city, about how to create a sustainable path for them. But I don't believe that the benefits that are provided to the community are well understood, and how the harbor and waterfront plays into the overall thriving of our community and the city. So I think there's work to be done, and not something that I think can be done in the short period of time by which we would be in November. I mean, and just generally, I think one measure is probably the most you'd want to bring forward at one time, though cities have done multiple measures simultaneously, but typically that's not recommended. So that is, the sales tax measure, which is discussed earlier, would render $2 million sort of as we expect to be a reasonable amount that would come through, and some of those funds certainly could be used to address some of the issues in the Harbor Fund at this time. There's no reason those funds could not be used for that if that was the direction council would like to go.
Okay. Regarding the Coastal Commission, with respect to paid parking and also outdoor spaces for restaurants, I agree with Councilmember Davis that this is extremely critical for our restaurants to have outdoor spaces for dining this summer. What would be the consequences to the city? I know we're discussing these things with them, but what would be the consequences, likely consequences to the city, if we acted quickly and implemented paid parking and outdoor seating in our restaurants, so that we could benefit from those revenues this summer?
I can't speak to the enforcement side. I just know that we do have our general plan. We're continuing to work on some other projects, as well as the vacation rental policy. It's still in development. All those things would require Coastal Commission review and approval to be put into effect, to be made into reality. So, I think we have to think of the long-term position with them. That is just how it works for our community. So beyond what may be enforcement actions that Scott can speak to, I think it's just the long-term relationship that's important. Again, we've impressed upon them the need to create flexibility, which maybe isn't part of their culture typically, but I think they understand, and the executive director of the Coastal Commission, who came in with a different approach than previous executive directors and trying to really unleash their staff to do good work and to be flexible, is resonating. And so I think we could see some movement, especially hopefully on the outdoor spaces and RV camping. Again, I think the paid parking is a much more significant undertaking, especially on our own side, to determine what our true needs are and what will work for our business community and our general community. Scott may have some more information about what enforcement actions could come from just sort of moving forward without.
Yeah, I mean, Coastal Commission, I mean, I would say right now is their reaction to COVID-19 and the needs for the cities on the coast of California has actually been pretty good. We needed to act to close down the Rock parking lot. We were experiencing issues there with social distancing.
And the Coastal Commission came up with a waiver program whereby we sent them the information related to that as we were shutting the rock down, and they sent the waiver back like a day later. So they were very responsive into the needs of, each community along the coast, doing what it needs to do to address, the emergency situation we found ourselves in. They continue to state that they're also cognizant of that on the economic impact side of things and trying to work with us on coming up with policy to roll that out to similarly, I think, facilitate and streamline the permit process for some of these what I would term, interim measures, to get our economy back up and rolling. And that's what they indicated to me. I'm going to take them at their word until they show me otherwise. As far as, what we could be facing, $10,000 a day fines. Coastal Commission a few years ago through the legislature got the ability to fine folks that are violators, and that's the minimum fine they issue. So I don't know that we would want to be anywhere around that. And I agree with Scott, there's also the sort of detrimental impact on all of the other things that we have that we're working on that require Coastal Commission, weigh in, approval, authorization, certification, that type of thing.
Okay, so thanks for that, Scott, Graham. It sounds like you have a good relationship with Coastal Commission, which is extremely important. It also sounds like they're very willing to work with us, which is excellent. Having said that, it is kind of the roadblock here that we're looking at has more to do with building consensus in our business community. And if so, how do we go about doing that so that we can do the right thing for the majority of businesses who stand to lose money if we don't do something this summer?
Yeah, if the word comes back that we can't use the kind of cul-de-sac areas, if you will, or the dead-end areas for outdoor dining, then we would probably need to go back to the business community and say, look, waterfront businesses, if you want to have more flexible use, we're going to have to look at that road a little differently. And it may change their minds if in fact, the Coastal Commission is just flat out not going to allow for use of those other areas. So I think that would be a different discussion if we had that input from Coastal.
I didn't mean to interrupt. I'm sorry.
That's okay. Yeah, go ahead.
Is the chamber leading the charge in surveying restaurants and retail owners regarding what their needs are and surveying what they need for this summer to survive? Is that the vehicle kind of that's doing that?
Yeah, that seems to be the best method to get input. Obviously, not everybody has the wherewithal to participate in Zoom calls every day. But Erica is leading those, it seems like, every single day. And we are, whether it's Scott or I or others in the staff, are participating as many of those as we can and just kind of picking up through those calls, the consensus, but also doing direct surveys to all businesses as well. So that's where we're getting a lot of the input from.
Okay. Then I have a question about the water treatment fund. So at this point, we're paying 75% of the expenses and Cayucos is paying 25%. When Cayucos goes offline, does that ratio stay the same, or do we pay 90% and they pay 10%? And if so, what is that included in the projections here for future years?
Great question. We will begin to engage in that with Cayucos. Get a better idea of when they would go offline. Of course, they'll complete their project, but then they have to do testing and all of those things to get to maintain compliance before they're completely shut off from us. So I think there's flexibility for this year, but we are going to be engaging with Rick Kuhn about that very issue. And I think that's going to play into the longer term with regard to not only the revenues, but also the jointly owned property with the existing wastewater treatment plant. So I think a lot of those discussions will begin in earnest shortly.
Okay.
And be able to give you a better indication then, but Jen might have more information too.
Yeah, I apologize. I said 75-25% earlier, and it's actually 60-40. So we pay 60%. It's based on flows, but okay. I just wanted to correct that. And we are presuming, at least in the budget that's presented, that the joint plant will remain operational through the whole year. As that changes as we go out through the year, we'll adjust those numbers and come back to the council.
So you're talking 2021, it'll remain the same as it is now?
That's what we have included.
That's what you're saying. Okay. Good. Thank you for answering that. And then my last question is, my mother always said, and a lot of people say, you know, prepare for the worst and hope for the best. Do your projections right here, are you preparing us for the worst, or is this more leaning towards hoping for the best, or is it somewhere in the middle, or how would you assess this projection?
If you recall, when we had our recovery discussion at the end of April, we presented three scenarios, kind of best case scenario, moderate, and worst case. This proposed budget kind of lands between, it's closest to the moderate, but lands between moderate and worst case. I think our TOT projections fall closer along worst case scenario. We have adjusted them up a little bit, meaning additional revenues based on what we saw for March. We were a little bit higher for April than what we've seen come in so far. There's a couple days left to receive TOT. So we're, like I said, monitoring that really, really closely every month to see where we're at. Overall, I think we're hedging a little closer to worst case. I think we're being very conservative. Again, recognizing maybe there's another surge in the fall and we want to be prepared for that if businesses have to close down again.
Okay. That's my last question. Thank you both for all your work. Great job.
Thank you. Thank you, Councilmember Heller. Councilmember Addis, questions, please.
Hi, yes. My biggest question is just where do the chamber and the various bargaining units and the waterfront businesses land with all of these different budget increase proposals? Like, are we seeing something favored over another in terms of revenue generation from all of these different groups? And have you heard that kind of feedback from any of them for a preference of one revenue generation measure over another?
Okay, got understood. We didn't ask our bargaining units directly, though they've in the past have referenced paid parking and also sales tax as well. The Government Affairs Committee has indicated support for a wide variety of things. I think, again, to sort of answer the question that Mr. Heller asked is, like, what's the right mixture of things? And it seems to be that they support, letting the community decide with regard to a sales tax, and then also pursuing those things that will assist businesses like the outdoor dining. So I think, by and large, what's being presented today reflects what we've heard in the community. Beyond that, obviously there's hope from waterfront businesses that perhaps there could be some relief from repaying all of the rents that are being deferred. That's sort of the input that we've received to date.
I would maybe just piggyback off of that a little bit and say that I think there's an astute understanding from not only the business community with the chamber, but our employees. Obviously, sales tax brings the most revenue and most impact, but it's really a combination of all the new revenue sources that will lead to long-term sustainability. We don't know how long restaurants and businesses will have reduced capacity, so to provide them an opportunity to have that outdoor seating, to transition through parking, and then the sales tax bringing upwards of $2 million or $1.5 million. Is substantial, and I think everybody is very well in tune with the need for a combination of all of those to be sustainable.
And it used to be that when we looked at revenue generation ideas, cannabis was on here. I'm assuming that dropped off based on the vote at the last council meeting. Is that why it's not listed as one of the major kind of revenue
yes,
ideas?
It, as far as a decision point, the council's already made that decision. Well, there's a second reading, so I don't want to I don't want to speak out of turn, but the indication from the first reading was support for adult use, and then looking into other other opportunities for business development, whether it's testing, cultivation, or manufacturing. So that's why we pulled it off, because it's council's indicated support for those measures.
Okay. Go ahead.
Just to kind of add to that a little bit, again, our revenue policy stipulates that new revenue sources such as cannabis would be used for one-time expenditures for the first 2 years. So any revenue that we receive from the cannabis shops that open up will not go towards balancing the general fund budget immediately. We would probably be recommending those be allocated to some of our other internal service funds that are below the minimum funding level, like our facilities replacement and maintenance and our vehicle maintenance. And after 2 years, then they kind of merge back into the general fund budget as our base revenue source.
And then I feel like that when this has come forward before to look at revenue generation, there's been talk of like opportunity sites and opportunity zones for development, but I'm seeing that has dropped off as well. Is that because there's a pathway forward in some of those areas, or is that because we're no longer looking in that direction?
No, that I think that we're looking at things you can make a decision on to make happen relatively soon. Opportunity sites are always there and present, but you don't have an opportunity in front of you at this time. We're not presenting. Nobody's come to us to say, well, we want to do X development, and what does your council think? That's part of the issue. But we, yes, absolutely maintain the importance of marketing those and keeping that as part of the discussion. And there may be opportunities in the near future which we would bring forward to council. But there's not anything, any action you can take today regarding them. That's why those aren't listed here.
Okay. And then is there any major resistance that you're hearing for the idea of a sales tax? I know it polled well. I know you've said the business community through the chamber is well aware of the need for a combined way to generate revenue, but are you here? I haven't personally heard major push, like major concerns. I know the group that you pulled together, and thank you for doing that. The group of citizens that you pulled together was favorable, but is there any major pushback around there or concerns that have come forward?
To be honest, there hasn't been much on that front. That's not to say that there aren't concerns out there, even amongst those who support it. We're very cognizant of the tenuous position our community is in, businesses and the like, and our community members. But I think that was why it was important that we engage with at least our local business community and to see what their feelings were, both through the Government Affairs Committee and through this roundtable. And I think it's because they understand the value of what the city provides, the value proposition for them and for our community members, and that the long-term sustainability is key, and that this measure will allow us to achieve that if it's successful and our community agrees it's successful. And the fact that other communities are considering the same thing won't create necessarily a competitive disadvantage for the city if we were successful. So I think all those things factor into it. But I obviously we're concerned that about the overall impact to our community. And so that's why we've engaged in this long effort of community outreach and engagement to understand where the concerns are.
That's all my questions. Thank you for your hard work on this. I know it's got to be an incredible amount of hours to put it together. So very much appreciate your time on it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Councilmember Addis. Councilmember McPherson, questions, please.
I do have a few. Thank you, Mr. Mayor, and let me echo the thanks. This is truly a remarkable document, over 500 pages. I am astounded at how much work has gone into it, and I want to thank the entire team, everybody that participated in it, and especially Scott and Jen and the department heads, and also the roundtable. I appreciated that they weighed in. So I unfortunately got a few questions very late to the team, and they managed to answer them for me, but I hadn't have time to look at them, so I'm going to have to ask some of them publicly. A lot of my questions have been asked, especially about the revenue sources, but I do have a few about the cuts that we are proposing in the budget that I would like to pursue, and I'm going to combine a few of them. I noted that the visitor center contract was canceled and there's no money for a visitor center next year, and obviously much reduced and no money for a tourism manager, and we dropped one maintenance person out of the budget, and yet we're projecting a higher workload. I'm just wondering what the consequences are going to be, since tourists are coming to town, on our tourism industry of the cuts that we are making in this budget. And also, I didn't see anything about the wayfinding signs, which I know we've talked about for a long time, but I didn't see that in the budget. So if you could address that kind of broad issue of the impact on our tourist services with these cuts.
Yes, I do our best with that. And I might turn to Jen for on the maintenance side, and Scott Graham / Jen for wayfinding. But with regard to the visitor center, we have already been having pretty extensive talks about proper location and just the methodology of providing that important service to our visitors. And then we had COVID-19 in March and had to shut everything down. And so it just didn't make sense to pay for a service we couldn't provide. And so we pulled the plug on that. And then looking at our inability to market at this time, it's not proper to market when there's a pandemic and when our governor said that leisure travel is prohibited at this time. It's not the appropriate time to do that. Plus, our revenues are down significantly in the TBIT assessment. So all those factors played into the decision to, unfortunately, go the tourism manager who's done an exceptional job, and also close our visitor center. We had a good discussion with the TBID advisory board to maintain flexibility. And I told them that's the goal here, is to set aside revenues and use them strategically when we are able to. And in talking with some of our lodging partners in the region, they also expressed that perhaps marketing doesn't make sense, even when we're allowed to, because the pent-up demand will be such that you don't need to market. In other words, people are going to go to the well-worn paths that they know, which they've been doing, coming to Pismo and coming to Morro Bay. We may not need to spend those funds now, and hold back and do it more strategically, along with a longer-term vision, which, in my opinion, makes sense to pull together a smaller group of lodging stakeholders, including TBID members, to really look at this question closely, since we have some time to evaluate. So that's the basis of that. And then the maintenance employee, one of our employees got a job in the water and sewer area, leaving a maintenance position vacant. That is a budgetary savings piece. And yes, there will be impacts. We are trying to continue to strive to provide trash and restroom services down in the Rockin and Embarcadero area and being flexible as we can, including a council member help us down there, which we really appreciate. So we want to approach that with flexibility and maybe look at alternative staffing models to do that. But rehiring that position would just make it hard for us to balance our budget. So that was sort of the thinking there. And then wayfinding, either Scott or Jen can talk about what we have available for funding for next year.
So, Councilmember McPherson, the wayfinding is funded in the Economic Development Fund, so there's an appropriation of $120,000 that's to support not only wayfinding and other potential general plan implementation items, but our contract with the Chamber for Ombudsman services. So that's where the wayfinding is funded. To speak a little bit more on the consolidated maintenance, I think that you get to a broader point of service reductions and impacts that the community will feel from our front counter here at City Hall with reducing our staffing here. Every phone call may not get picked up because we're only going to have two people that are out there available to pick up the phone calls. And we also oftentimes have customers here, phones ringing at the same time, and it might have to go to voicemail. We might not be able to process everything as quickly as we have typically tried to do from a consolidated maintenance perspective. Service requests will likely take longer. There's one position vacant. We have another employee that's out on family leave for a period of time, so we're really down two positions in there. The decision to lay off the consolidated maintenance superintendent was to preserve as much of those frontline service providers that we could, but there still will be impacts as to delays in service requests, and we haven't funded things like that we typically have funded, like sidewalk grinding, as much street maintenance and repairs that we typically do, contract for tree services if there's tree issues, and as some of those arise throughout the year, we'll have to visit those on a case-by-case basis and identify funding and come back to council unless we see some dramatic increases in our revenues this first quarter or first few months of the fiscal year, and we can appropriate some funds or set some funds aside at that point if we see that happen. But there will be impacts that will be felt by the community in that we've reduced our FTEs by almost 10 in the general fund. So with 10 less people, that's a significant reduction in staff hours to respond to some of the community needs.
And how about the impacts of the, there's three additional people, four total in public works. What are the likely impacts on the public work projects from being down that many staff?
Yeah, so the consolidated maintenance superintendent, he oversaw the consolidated maintenance program. So from getting quotes on projects to, you know, invoicing, writing specs, you know, workload assignments and projects and prioritization, responding to some of the service requests that would come in from the community and phone calls. So we've met and we've delegated and reallocated that work out between the remaining members in the department. Our field supervisor and superintendent is taking on a big additional workload and helping to prioritize projects and ordering supplies and getting quotes. Our management analyst is helping with the invoicing and PO and contract processing piece of that. But again, it's you know, a less position, and it's going to take longer when you're adding those duties on to people that are already, you know, at capacity. Our engineering, we laid off one engineer. The creation of the city engineer position, there's still two engineering spots left, but reviews will take longer or be on hold, and we'll have to be prioritizing those as they come in. And then our consolidated maintenance, I think we addressed that with the position that we lost that was vacant due to that employee moving to our utilities department. And then our office assistant, who really did all the entering of the PO, she was reallocated to the utility department. She was already partially funded there. And our management analyst and our finance department, our AP person, will be helping to relieve some of the workload that she used to handle on the general fund side.
So you're going to try to make do.
We're going to try to make do. I think in one of the slides we had a note that some of these service reductions are really, well, they're forcing us to think creatively on how to provide services. Some, they should really be thought of as temporary in some cases, because it's not manageable or sustainable for the long run. And as we recover from the pandemic, as our economy, you know, recovers and rebounds, and we see some relief ahead, some reallocation or bringing back on board of positions will probably be recommended just in order to provide the service that the community has come to expect and deserves.
Okay, thank you. Now, I know that the budget that you have put together relies on the salary reductions that go through for several unions and for management through December 31st of 2020. What assumptions did you make for the second half of the fiscal year with respect to salaries?
So the proposed budget includes the 8 to 5% of salary concessions for the city manager, department directors, management employees, unrepresented employees, SEIU, and the police association employees through December 31st, at which time from January through June 30th, the forecast in the budget is reinstating salaries back to the normal amount. And that is because we are committed to the contract extensions expire December 31st with those unions. And we are committed to engaging in contract negotiations again when we have more information available about our revenues and the overall impact from COVID-19. The fire association members, their salaries are status quo as we're in negotiations and we'll be continuing negotiating with them. Their contract expires June 30th. And then the council stipend waivers were through this the current fiscal year, so June 30th. So there still are council stipends programmed into the proposed budget. The planning commissioner waivers stipends were waived through the end of the calendar year, I believe, and that's what we accounted for in the budget.
Okay, so basically you returned most people to their previous.
As of January 1st, yes.
Okay. And in the 10-year budget projections, when were you basically expecting or foreseeing or building in some kind of a COVID recovery so that things might eventually get back to normal, assuming that we'll have a vaccine in 1 to 2 years? I'm just curious because they were pretty dire predictions for the future. In terms of recovery, I felt. So I was curious to know what your assumptions were.
Yeah, there's so many different factors that go into this. When unemployment, when the extra unemployment benefit runs out, it'll be interesting to see what happens to the economy and the discretionary spending when people don't have an extra $600 in their hand. There's a vaccine that comes on, where's the economy sitting at that point, and are people back employed and choosing discretionary leisure travel? So understanding that there's a lot of those unknowns out there, we're looking at kind of a gradual regrowth with sales tax coming back, 5 to 1.5%, 5 to 7% from fiscal year 2021 or 2022-23, through 2028-29. Our property tax have that fairly stagnant. And then TOT starting in 2021-22, and it compounds each year. We have 10%, 15%, 18% increases, and then it's slowing down in 2025-26 as we are reaching back to our pre-COVID numbers. And by that time, we may have an additional hotel on board or something like that if the Atascadero Hotel continues.
Okay, thank you. And just maybe one or two more questions. I know we received an email talking about the diversification of revenue sources. And I'm wondering, I guess this is for the city manager, if we are working through the chamber on that. Are we actually, this is not the opportunity sites, but rather really looking to diversify our economy and bring in more types of industries and businesses into town. Are we working on that at all?
Yeah, it's, everything sort of got shunted aside with response to COVID-19 and assisting our existing businesses in triage. Which I think is the right thing to do in that moment, and we're still doing that in chambers as well. So we definitely want to keep our mind to the future, and transformational change is part of that, which means looking at different industries, whether it's offshore wind or, potentially battery projects or the like. There's still going to be opportunities for our community if the conditions are right. And then, looking at how we do business as a city, the planning review process, and these opportunities for flexibility like outdoor dining and RV camping and the like. I think we're sort of ushering in a period of flexibility where we need to be nimble. Of course, that's made challenging by the fact that we're shrinking our workforce, but nonetheless, that's the challenge we have to rise to And the chamber has been a great partner in that, and their government affairs committee is an exceptional cast of members of our community that are helping in that process and helping push us as well. So we definitely are going to start to pick that up again, and I know there will be opportunities soon. That's my feeling.
Okay. And just one more question on the parking management study and possibility. Would we require a coastal development permit if we were to just do some sort of a very simple pilot project where we might put a kiosk up at one parking lot in town just to see what happens, like for a three-month period during the summer when we hopefully will have tourists here?
Yes, I don't have the answer to that. I think that's something we could engage with them on. Just important to note, if you are to create a paid parking lot in a sea of free parking, people will find the free parking. People are going to seek out what is the cheapest, and that's just been proven time and time again with previous parking studies and what I've seen in other cities. So, for instance, if we were to use a lot below Distasios and made that a paid parking, you probably would see lower utilization and greater utilization of the adjacent areas nearby in the neighborhood and or in front of businesses. So it is something we can definitely talk to Coastal Commission about, but my general feeling is we want to understand our parking, needs and impacts prior to going in that direction.
Okay. This question, if things actually got worse instead of better, I know that we have a number of fund balances so that we actually have other monies that we could tap into. Is it legal to borrow from the enterprise funds and pay them back if we needed it for the general fund?
Yes, that can be done, and obviously you'd be very, very careful in doing that and creating expectations and agreements about interest rates and payback periods of time and those kind of things. And it certainly has been done in other cities, and we do loan in the other direction from the general fund out, so that's been done in the past. We're hopeful that we don't have to turn to that, and that this budget proposal can get us through. And if we are successful in receiving state or federal assistance, that could backfill, or if we pursue sale of properties, that could also help backfill where we would need to go to that direction. But yes, that is there's flexibility for that. You just have to make sure it's specified for what the use is, how it'd be paid back, and over what period of time.
Okay, thank you. And this is, I think, my last question. And I noted that there's a number of differences between your proposed budget and the recommendations in the roundtable report. Is this something you'd like us to comment on at this meeting?
If there are particular aspects of the report that or ideas that council would like further discussion on, and there's insufficient time, we certainly can do that at a later date before adoption of the budget.
Okay, thank you. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Councilmember McPherson. Just for everybody's note, AGP has another meeting, and we will have a hard stop time of 5:45. So that's just a heads up with that. Great questions on the part of council. I'm going to forego my questions, as about 90% of them were already answered. So I'm going to move into just my summary discussion, and then ask each of you to more or less give input based upon the information that was asked by staff. First comment that I want to make is that I'm extremely proud of the work that our staff, not only Scott and Jen, but our department managers, the staff that participated in the budget preparation team, the CFAC committee, Citizens Finance Committee, as well as the special committee that was convened on looking at revenues. I so appreciate broad community input. Secondarily, I'm so proud of the way that information is presented by the city. We have award-winning budget preparation documents, and I'm very proud of that. I want to commend staff on that. You know, one of the tenets for crisis management, at least in my experience in managing larger organizations, is really based upon a quick reaction to major downturns or major changes in trends. One of the things that I'm particularly proud of and very happy that the council did, if you look in the budget document on pages A4 through A8, we have built a foundation for financial policies or of financial policies that have guided a significant amount of the responses that you have seen by staff. And without that foundation or that guiding document, I think we might be in a very different position. I'm proud of the fact that our staff reacted extremely quickly, recognized a major precipitated downturn in revenue streams, and acted very quickly to respond to that, such that we were able to fend off, I think, major decreases in revenue sources and or negative position for the city as a whole if we hadn't acted as quickly. And thank you, Mr. Collins, for implementing the financial crisis management plan extremely quickly. The second thing that staff did very quickly was to analyze the impact on the city. And Jen, I'm especially thankful to you for the analysis that you did and presented to us previously with the three different cases, the most likely, perhaps the worst case, and the best case scenario. I think it gave us a good idea of the magnitude of issues that we were facing and what we needed to do as a city. And the third thing is in taking quick action, you didn't look past yourselves. And in fact, that includes council as well. And I'm proud of the fact that the first consideration by management was a reduction in management salaries. That's sometimes a very difficult thing to do, but that hard decision was made very quickly. And I'm appreciative not only of that, but our two bargaining units that agreed to a reduction of 5%, that made such a huge difference in the position that we're in now. And I can't overemphasize how proud I am of our employees for recognizing that. The other policy issue that I think that council is going to benefit from right now, I know is going to benefit from right now, is the fact that we decided several years ago to set our reserves between 25 and 28%. That is significantly higher than is recommended by the Financial Organization for Cities. When the audit was completed and we talked to, or I asked a question specifically of our auditors, what are the usual reserves that cities maintain? The answer was about 16% on average. If we hadn't created that policy, we wouldn't have the amount of reserves that we have now, which are available to be used by us for this rainy day. And nobody likes to draw down on reserves, but that kind of planning is exactly necessary for situations like COVID-19 and the issues that we are facing. And so, I am so proud, again, of all of you and all of us for the actions that we have taken. Nonetheless, that being said, we're facing significant issues with ongoing revenues. I think the plan that you have presented, in my opinion, is, as Jen may have said, between the very conservative or worst case and the moderate case. And I think that's good, prudent planning. And I would hope that if we do better, that we would be able to not draw down on our reserves as significantly as we're planning to do over the next period. The other thing I'll say is in my opinion, this is a very dynamic budget this year rather than a static budget. And I think, and I know, and part of my recommendation is that council needs to be updated very routinely and at least, if not monthly, quarterly on our current position as data comes in. Because if the situation gets more dire and is worse than expected, we need to be able to react quickly to that. And so I'm considering this to be more or less a dynamic versus a static budget for this year. With regard to the questions that you've asked, first I'll start with maybe one of the largest questions, and that is the sales tax question. And I'm thankful to the group, Mr. Collins, that you convened that made recommendations to us on a number of issues. They have recommended a 1% sales tax increase. In my calculation, if you look at our current 0.5% sales tax, that is a special tax that comes to the city through Measure Q. If you backfill in the numbers and look at what that generates, that generates approximately $1.2 million per year. And if you do a reverse calculation, that means that there's a total spend of about $240 million that generates that sales tax. Realizing that tourists pay about 70% of sales tax and that about 30% is paid by local individuals, if you do the math and you run the calculation out based upon a population of 10,500, on a per capita basis, there is about a $6,857 spend per year, or about $35 per year tax generated on $6,800 spending per capita. Where am I going with this? Well, a 1% sales tax with 30% of it being borne by our community members translates to a cost per resident of approximately $70 per year or 20 cents per day. I think first and foremost in my mind, it's extremely important that tourists pay their fair share for city infrastructure costs and other costs because of the significant use of resources that they consume. And I also think that given the fact that this will generate significant revenues for the city, that it's a small price to pay, even though any price to pay is something that's an important consideration for all of us. But it's a small price to pay per resident for a very large increase in revenue for the city. So I am very supportive of the 1% sales tax as recommended on page 9. The other issues that you have asked questions about, RV capping. I do support looking at RV camping, and I concur with the recommendations of the subcommittee that looked at that. I think that could be beneficial, could also generate significant revenues and be an opportunity for us this coming year. I do support a further look at paid parking as soon as possible. Again, I think the recommendation by the subcommittee is well articulated, and I support their recommendation. With regard to the sale of properties, and looking at, again, the subcommittee's recommendation, I would agree with taking off of the table the consideration for looking at the potential second fire department property for sale. However, the remainder properties that are discussed in the report, I would support in at least getting an assessment of their value and then letting council make a decision on evaluating are there potential revenue streams that might be better for those properties long term, or would a spinoff more appropriately benefit the city in terms of decreasing the drawdown on our reserves with a one-time sale of those properties. And you've asked a question with regard to, let me get back to page 9. Sorry, I'm shuffling my notes here. Pardon me one second. The issue of expansion of our businesses, I think a number of council members have weighed in on that. I have talked to a number of our restaurateurs as well. Councilmember Davis, Councilmember Heller have both mentioned the need for further expansion. And I would like to see us move as quickly as possible to move forward with regard to allowing that to happen. We've got to get our businesses up and running quickly. We've got to reach out to the Coastal Commission and follow up quickly with regard to this and make a case for survival of our city with regard to these revenues. And so I would add that to the list of potential considerations and recommendations and ask that we go ahead and take a look at that. And I believe I have covered all of the items that you asked for feedback on, realizing that we will have a full discussion at the next council meeting on the budget as well. So with that, those are my summary comments, and I will move to Councilmember McPherson first. Your summary comments?
Well, first, let me tell you that I really totally agree with everything that you said. I think I can just say ditto in my summary comments because I just kept nodding my head here. Yes, 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 yes. And we do obviously need regular updates because we know things are going to change. So I support where we're going and I support the budget. I'm just so proud of our staff for having put together such an incredible document. So thank you.
Great. Thank you for those comments. Councilmember Heller.
Yes, thank you, Mayor. To go down the list here, sale of properties. I'm opposed to sale of properties with exception of the larger parcels in Choral Valley. There is some demand, I believe, for storage of vehicles, which those properties are appropriate for, and I doubt that the value of those properties are going to go up and down very much in the future, so I'm okay with selling those. The property residential lot, the 7,000-square-foot lot at Bolton, I would sell that property, but only if we can get a good price for it. I don't see that we're in a position right now to give it away, and I would not want that to happen. The properties that we own in the inner city core, I'd like to try and consolidate city services into a smaller footprint and lease the space that might free up. And I would not sell any of those. RV waterfront camping, I support that completely. I want to make sure, however, before we dive into it, that we have a good handle on what the true revenues will actually be from making that move. It seems like it's fairly staff intensive to me, but I could be wrong about that. Paid parking, I'd like to see something happen with the parking lots at the Rock. And since I have firsthand experience in the demand on the trash at those lots, the portable toilets, which cost the city money, the restrooms, which we try and keep clean. It's a great resource for Californians to come to those two lots and spend the day or spend a few hours. I think we need to start collecting revenue immediately on those two lots, and I'm hoping the Coastal Commission will support that. Microloan program here is listed, although we really didn't discuss it. It sounds like it might be something handled by banks, unless there's a pressing need that we can get this done with no demand of our staff time. I'm okay with it, but otherwise I'm kind of neutral on it. Outdoor dining, let's identify the restaurants that really want that, and let's make that happen this summer. Those are my comments. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Councilmember Heller. And let's move to Councilmember Davis, sir.
Thank you, yes. I'm in favor of everything that the mayor mentioned, including the sales tax. I didn't hear Councilmember Heller weigh in on the sales tax. But yes, I support the RV camping. I support the parking management. I support the outdoor dining, pushing ahead with that aggressively. I hesitate about selling the lot at the corner of Shasta and Dunes. We've programmed that for bocce ball, which is a temporary use, but we have also considered that for expansion of city facilities as a way, as Councilmember Heller said, of consolidating our resources. I would want to hang on to that. The property next to it, if we can get a return on investment sufficient to offset any capital costs of renovating that, I would prefer to keep that property and lease it out. But definitely want to sell the property up in the Harbor District. I think if we can get a good price, as Council Member Heller says, because we have no use for it, and it is a very valuable piece of property. So those are my thoughts.
Thank you, Council Member Davis. Council Member Heller, did you want to weigh in on sales tax or give you an opportunity?
I haven't taken a position on the sales tax yet, Mayor. Thank you.
Okay.
Brad.
You bet. Thank you. And I'll make a note.
I think we forgot one piece. Do you mind?
I just want to make one note that Council Member Addis had to leave, had another appointment, so she will not be giving a summary. But yes, go ahead, please.
I think one thing to keep in mind with the Dunes and Shasta pieces of property is that if they are sold, it's a one-time revenue, but there's also an ongoing revenue impact. If it's developed into something, there's property tax value that's added to that and added as an ongoing revenue source. So I think we forgot to mention that earlier.
Great. Thank you for that. Hopefully, Mr. Collins and Ms. Calloway, you have the information you needed. Are there any questions with regard to the summaries?
No, just to note that we are doing agenda production tomorrow for the next council meeting, so that the next budget discussion would be the discussion on most likely on the 23rd, where you would also do the adoption. Just wanted to make that note clear. So sorry, I think we had held out the 9th for a special meeting in case there were some follow-up, and if council so desires for there to be specific follow-up, we could see what we can do to make that happen for the 9th. Otherwise, we would be coming back to you on the 23rd.
Yeah, and I think given your abilities and the timing, the 23rd is fine. I think I probably misspoke earlier. I had maybe assumed previously we were coming back on the 9th, but 23rd should be just fine.
Just want to say that when I agree with you on the sale of properties, what I agree with is coming back with more information about how much we could get doing various things if we rented out or leased out or sold, and the costs and the benefits, as opposed to talking about individual properties at this point.
And that was my recommendation as well. So
that
thank you.
My recommendation. Thank you.
Okay.
I'm with Council Member McPherson on that as well.
Great. Okay. Any other questions from staff?
Thank you for the really good discussion and input and direction. Really, really helpful. Thank you.
Again, we appreciate staff and all the work that you do during these difficult times. I know we say it a lot, but we mean it. With that, I will go ahead and adjourn our meeting. The next regular meeting of the Morro Bay City Council will be on Tuesday, June 9th, 5:30 p.m. via Zoom. Be safe and be well, and thank you, council members. Appreciate that.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.